Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Good afternoon, everyone. Okay, we will continue now with our study of the Sutta Nipata. And last time I started to discuss the last sutta in the first chapter of the Sutta Nipata. This is the Muni Sutta, the sutta dealing with the sage. As I explained last time, the word Muni in Pali suggests the idea of one who is observes silence. That is, this is the sage whose wisdom comes from a deep inner silence. It doesn't necessarily mean one who doesn't speak at all. In fact, the Buddha is called Sakyamuni, the sage of the Sakyan clan. Not because he doesn't speak, he's spoken volumes and volumes of discourses. But the sage is one whose words, we can say, come forth from a deep inner silence and give expression to this deep inner silence that comes from the stilling and quieting of the mind and from the realization of that deep inner peace, that ultimate peace of the mind. Okay, last time I discussed the first four verses of the Muni Sutta. And these first four verses form almost, it would seem, an independent poem. And now, beginning with verse number 5, according to the commentary, each of these verses was spoken independently by the Buddha according in response to a particular incident, and the commentary gives background stories to each of these verses. I have to say I don't find this explanation perfectly or completely convincing, and in some respects I could see these verses adhering together, cohering together almost into a single poem as a kind of celebration of the sage, the silent sage. And we could see that they are all praising the person who has reached this ultimate attainment, this highest ideal. And so these verses taken together give a kind of picture of, from one angle at least, from one angle they give a picture of the very early Buddhist conception of the fully realized, fully accomplished spiritual master. I say from one angle because there are many different pictures, many different portraits that the Buddhist texts give us of a fully accomplished master. And this is a picture given from one particular perspective, that perspective which emphasizes this drive for the realization of the ultimate, which emphasizes renunciation, detachment, the striving for inner wisdom, the abandoning of the multitude, the crowd, the courage, the conviction to break all bonds and fetters, to wander alone without any companion, in quest of the highest ideal. Okay, so we'll start now with verse number 5. And I'll recite in Pali, because the meter is very nice. And then I'll give translation and explanation. Sabha bibung sabha vidung sumedang sabhe sudamme suanu palitang sabhan jahang tanha kaye vimutang tang va pidira muning vediyanta. Okay, the translation here. One who has overcome all, who knows or understands all, who is intelligent or very wise, who does not cling to any object, who has abandoned everything, who has freed himself by destroying desire, or more literally, who is liberated in the destruction of craving. This one, the wise, know as a sage. Okay, now, a verse very, very similar to this. Actually, the first three lines are identical. Was spoken by the Buddha in the period right after his enlightenment, when he had spent a period of time right after his enlightenment sitting in the vicinity of the Bodhi tree, contemplating the truths that he had realized for some time. Texts say, according to some texts, 7 weeks. Then he considered whether he should go out and teach the Dhamma. Finally, he made that decision to go to teach. Then he was walking from the area of the Bodhi tree to Sarnath, to the deer park near Benares, where the 5 ascetics were living. And he was intending to give his first teaching to these 5 ascetics. And along this road, he met a wandering ascetic whose name was Upaka, who saw him walking very calmly, very peacefully, his faculties restrained, his features very radiant and calm. And this ascetic approached him and said to him, "Your manner is very serene, very tranquil. It seems to me that you are a very highly realized person. Who is your teacher? Who is your spiritual guide? And whose teaching do you follow?" And then when the Buddha was asked these questions, then he recited this verse in reply, except the last line is different. Instead of saying, "He is the one that the wise call a sage," the Buddha said that there is no one that I point to as my teacher, that I am the one who is the enlightened one. I am fully enlightened by myself, so who can I point to as my teacher? So it seems that this verse itself, even in this form, is referring to the Buddha himself. So it can be taken in this form also, perhaps to refer to any enlightened person. So the first word, sabab, or expression, sabhabibhu, means one who has overcome all, or literally, it's one who has conquered all. And in the Buddha's time, a king or a powerful general is called a conqueror, Abhibhu. But the Buddha uses this expression to mean not one who is conquered in battle, conquered other human beings in battle, but one who has overcome and conquered all of the defilements of the mind. And so in a sense we could say that this gives us the kind of challenge to ourselves that we have to face in our own effort to follow the Buddha's path. It's not that of overcoming and conquering external barriers, conquering external people, confronting other people and trying to challenge them and overcome them. But the real task that the Buddha's teaching gives us is to overcome ourselves, to master ourselves, to conquer ourselves. In the Dhammapada, there's a famous verse where the Buddha says that if one should conquer in battle 1,000 times 1,000 men, and another person should conquer only one person, himself, the second is the greater conqueror. Okay, so the true sage, according to the Buddha, is one who overcomes all. And what is meant by all here is overcoming all the defilements of the mind. All of the Buddhas classify these defilements in many ways. 5 hindrances, the 7 latent tendencies, the 10 fetters, many, 4 types of clinging, 4 floods, 3 asavas, whatever the categories, the task in following the path is to overcome all of these defilements. And then the true sage is one who knows all or understands all. This is not a matter of collecting masses and masses of information, of factual information, but of understanding the truth about our own experience, our own nature. That means investigating with wisdom the truth about how do we experience things. Not in a scientific way, but understanding the nature of the sense faculties, how the sense faculties operate, how objects enter into the range of the sense faculties, how through the impact of objects on the sense faculties, contact takes place. Through contact, feeling arises. Through feeling, there occur perceptions, mental formations. And understanding the nature of these phenomena, that is to understand, in effect, that is to understand everything, to understand all. And then, through understanding all and overcoming all of these defilements, then the next line says, sabbesu dhammesu anupalitang. Here it's translated, who does not cling to any object. But I like a different way to translate this. I think more literal and somewhat better in bringing out the meaning. One who is not tainted amongst all phenomena. So that shows the consequence of overcoming all, of eliminating all of the defilements, that amidst all the phenomena of the world, one is no longer tainted, that different phenomena come into the range of one's experience, but they no longer taint one, in that the mind can no longer be swayed or influenced by these phenomena. This is illustrated, we'll come to the simile a few verses down. It's like the simile is given of the lotus flower, which grows in the mud, and then it comes up from the mud, and it rises above the surface of the muddy waters, and its petals are not soiled by the muddy water. So even though it's amidst the mud of the pond, but because its flower has risen above the mud of the pond, it can no longer be soiled by the mud. And so the one who has known the nature of all phenomena through wisdom eliminates all of the defilements of the mind, and so rises up above the world while still in the midst of the world. And so when any worldly phenomena come into the range of that person's experience, they no longer taint or influence the mind. Pleasant things, pleasant sights, pleasant sounds, pleasant smells, pleasant tastes no longer provoke craving or desire. Unpleasant, disagreeable forms, sounds, smells, tastes, bodily sensations no longer provoke aversion or displeasure, dislike. Okay, and then such a person has sabbanjahang. Such a person has given up or abandoned everything. What's meant here is given up, again, given up all of the defilements, all craving, all attachment. And then he is tanhakaye vimutang, liberated in the destruction of craving. Or as the verse, the translator here puts it, freed by destroying desire. Okay, so this person they call, the wise call, a sage. Okay, then we come to verse number 6.
Panya balang sila vatu papanang samahitang jana ratang satimang sangha pamutang akilang anasavang tang va pidira muning vedayanti.
Okay, to read the translation now. One who possesses the strength of wisdom. Then here I don't think the translation is correct. Not born of the moral precepts and restraints, but rather one who is endowed with or possessed of the moral precepts and observances, one could say, who is tranquil in mind or concentrated in mind, and who delights in meditation, and who is mindful, who is free from attachment, free from fallowness of mind, or sterility of mind, and is without the asavas, without the taints or the influxes, this person, the wise, call a sage. Okay, again, we see certain points of emphasis here in the qualities of the sage. The first line, first expression emphasizes this power of wisdom as being that particular force that turns or transforms a person into a sage. And wisdom here goes hand in hand with the observance of morality or moral virtue, righteous behavior. And so in the preparatory stages of the path, the Buddha says that wisdom and virtue are like the two hands which are necessary to wash one another. This is comes up in the discussion with a Brahmin in the Digha Nikaya. He says that you cannot have true virtue without wisdom, and you cannot have true wisdom without virtue. But just as you use the two hands, one left hand to wash the right hand, at the same time the right hand is washing the left hand, so virtue helps to purify wisdom, and wisdom helps to purify virtue. And so in the preparatory stages of development, these two, virtue and wisdom, are necessary to purify one another. Virtue is necessary as a foundation for wisdom, because virtue consists in the observance of those precepts which keep the unwholesome tendencies of mind under control. And by observing the principles of virtue, then one is able to keep the mind under control. One is able to keep the mind restrained, and by restraining the mind, one is able to develop mindfulness and concentration, which are emphasized in the second line of this verse. Mindfulness and concentration together bring the achievement of the meditative absorptions, the jhanas. And so, through the purification of behavior or conduct by observing sila, the precepts of virtue, one then purifies the mind by the practice of mindfulness and concentration to the point that one can gain the jhanas, the meditative absorptions. And through the practice of jhanas, one is able to overcome the hindrances. One is able to gain control of the thought processes, and one can eliminate the coarser mental factors and build up the strength of concentration, of samadhi, until one develops samadhi bala, that is the power of concentration. This is the ability to bring the mind together, to collect the mind together, and to hold the mind in unity, bringing the mind focused, collected, composed, so that instead of being shaken and scattered and dispersed, the mind can remain steady, unshaken, unshakable. When the mind can remain composed and steady, then one can use this collected mind to focus and upon and to investigate the nature of phenomena at subtler levels, much subtler levels than is available to the ordinary, unscattered mind. When the mind is scattered, dispersed, then one can't really dig deeply into the nature of things. We just see things very superficially. But it is when the mind is really focused that one can then tune in upon the actual nature of bodily phenomena. And one can then use that focused mind to scan through the body from top to bottom, even bringing in the whole body at one time, and see how the body is just this compound of ever-changing bodily phenomena arising and passing away. And one could focus in on the nature of the mental phenomena, feelings, perceptions, mental formations, and consciousness, and see how these mental phenomena are always impermanent, changing phenomena, always arising and passing away, conditioned by other phenomena. And so as one is penetrating at subtler and subtler levels the nature of these bodily and mental phenomena, wisdom is gathering more and more strength. And as wisdom gathers strength, it is purifying the mind of the gross, first of the grosser level of defilements. Then it is eliminating the subtler level of defilements. And then when all of the defilements are eliminated completely, then wisdom blossoms in its fullest strength and power. And that is the person who the Buddha calls a Muni, one who develops this fully purified strength of wisdom. And this is the wisdom of one who is completely freed from all of the ties, what are called the attachments here, who is free from the fallowness of mind. This means sterility of mind. This is the quality of mind when the mind is, sometimes the mind becomes very dry and hard, particularly sometimes when one is trying to practice meditation. Sometimes meditation can go very smoothly and the mind can flow very easily through the meditation practice. But then there come periods when one hits dry, hard soil where one seems one cannot make any progress at all. It's like entering upon hard ground where one can't grow any kind of vegetables, any kind of crops. That is what is meant by this Pali word, kila. It's soil that is not suitable for growing crops, barren soil. So one who has completely overcome that barrenness of the mind, that person is called a sage. And this is the person who is free from the intoxicants or the asavas. The asavas are the most primordial defilements, the deep underlying mental influences of craving for sensual pleasures, the craving for continued existence, and ignorance. One who has completely eliminated those three deep fundamental defilements, one who is without the influence of the asavas, that is a sage. Okay, then the next verse in Pali, it's a verse that has seven lines, very unusual. Ekang charantang muning apamantang ninda pasang sa suva vedamanang si hung fasade suva santa santang vatang vajalam hiya sa chamanang
padumang vatoyena alipamanang netaranganye sanganyaneyang tang vapidira muning vedayanti.
Okay, it speaks about the sage, the muni, as one wandering alone. The Buddha himself usually would be wandering in the midst, accompanied by a large sangha. The texts usually speak about the Buddha was traveling accompanied by a large company of monks. Sometimes they say that this large company consisted of 500 monks. Other texts say 1,250 monks. All of these figures, they might be exaggerations because that's the tendency of the texts. But we could understand generally that the Buddha would be traveling with a large number of monks because he was a teacher and there would be a large number of monks accompanying him wherever he would travel. And when he would set up residence someplace, there would be large numbers of people coming to hear him give sermons. When he would be at his regular residences in Savatthi or in Rajagaha, then kings and princes and prominent townspeople would come to hear him speak and would attend on him. But even the Buddha, every once in a while, in the very early hours of the morning when all the other monks would either be sleeping or quietly meditating, sometimes he would just pack his robe, extra robe, take his alms bowl, and just slip out of his dwelling and go wandering alone. Sometimes go traveling even a long distance because he liked to be alone, not to be surrounded by large numbers of people. And there would be numbers of followers of the Buddha who, when they really wanted to practice very seriously, they would realize that to stay in the midst of the Sangha would be suitable for those who are still in training, who still had to develop their faculties, since it was very beneficial to be close to the Buddha, close to accomplished monks. But once they developed a certain degree of strength, then the best mode of practice is to go off and to find a solitary place, to find a secluded cave, to find a nice grove with a tree where one could stay with the tree. No need to sweep, to mop. Well, one does have to sweep the area right under the tree to keep away the leaves and the branches that break off. But one doesn't have to worry about thieves breaking in and stealing one's belongings. And so there would be these ascetic monks, even throughout Buddhist Asia, even right up to the present day, there are monks who live this lifestyle, living alone, wandering alone. Though it gets more and more difficult when the forests are disappearing, the quiet village roads are disappearing, giving way to paved highways, paved motored roads. Okay, so the sage who wanders alone, diligent, undisturbed by praise or blame, then here we come to some similes. Like the lion, not frightened by any sounds. This is a very powerful image. The lion is the king of the beasts in the jungle. So the lion is never scared by the sound of any other animal. Even when the lion is walking through the jungle, if he hears the sound of some kind of hyena yelping, he's not afraid. If the lion hears the sound of an elephant trumpeting, he's not afraid of the elephant. If the lion hears the sound of even of the tiger roaring, the lion is not afraid of the tiger, because the lion is the king of the jungle, the king of the beasts. And so this is like the sage, the noble liberated arahant, who's not frightened by any sounds, not frightened by anything. Then, like a net not caught, just as a net is not caught in the wind, so he cannot be caught by any kind of objects of attachment. The mind doesn't stick to anything. It doesn't stick to anything that's attractive. When the Buddha uses the simile to illustrate how the great monk Mahakasapa goes amongst families, he goes amongst families in order to preach the Dhamma. He receives offerings from them, receives honor from them, but he leaves with the mind completely pure, completely unattached to them. This is like he compares Mahakasapa to the wind, which cannot be caught in the net. Or he compares him to like the hand moving through space. It's not stuck, not hindered. Whereas what happens to other monks, the Buddha says, whose minds are not yet developed, when they move amongst families, people make offerings to them, venerate them, then the mind becomes attached and they become swelled up with pride if people praise them. They become attached if people make offerings to them and they expect to get nice offerings, and they become dejected if they don't get such good quality offerings. But Venerable Mahakasapa just moves from place to place without any attachment. And then we come to this image of the lotus flower that I mentioned before, like the lotus not soiled or stained by the water. It's risen above the surface of the water, and so the mud, the dirt of the water doesn't soil its beautiful petals. And then such a one, by reason of his developed qualities, his inner strength, inner wisdom, inner purity, is able to become a leader of others, not one who is led or guided by others. So this one, the Buddha says, this is the one that the wise call a sage. Okay, then we'll come to the next verse. Yo ogane tambo riva bijayati yasmin pare vacha pariyan tangva danti tang vitaragang su sama hitendriyang tang va pidira muning vai dayanti. Okay, one who is firm as the post in a bathing place, controlled over what others say, who is passionless, whose senses are well composed. This one is called a sage by the wise. I was a little puzzled by this verse. I didn't quite understand it. So I looked at the explanation given by the commentary. And the commentary explained that, you see, in India in that time, in public bathing places, they would plant a post so that when people were bathing, they would be able to clean their backs by rubbing their backs against this post. And people from all different social grades would come to bathe in the same bathing place, and it could be high-class Brahmins come, they rub their backs against the bathing post, people from mill-grade merchant classes come and rub their backs against the bathing post. People from the serving classes come and rub against the bathing post. And the bathing post doesn't discriminate, doesn't judge. Ah, this one is a Brahmin rubbing against me. Now I'm a high-class bathing post. Now there's a low-grade servant coming and rubbing against me. Now my quality, I've gone down a few grades. But now there's a merchant coming to rub against me, so I've gone up a few points. But the bathing post just always remains the same. No discrimination at all, no distinctions, ever perfectly equanimous, no matter who comes to rub against the bathing post. And so this is the way to describe the mind of the person, of the sage. One whose mind remains equanimous, equal, no matter what happens, whether good or bad, favorable or unfavorable, the mind is always the same. Others come and approach and praise me. I don't get happy and uplifted. Ah, they said something good about me. Others come and say, you know, your lecture this afternoon, a little boring. I thought you're just repeating yourself too often. Don't get cast down. But remain perfectly the same, perfectly equanimous. And then controlled over what others say. I don't know, does that mean anything very clearly in English? Also, the Pali, it's a little obscure. But the basic point, again, the commentary gives a clear explanation, is that the statements of others come to an end when they reach this person. Again, what this means is that praise or blame, scolding or commendation come to an end, and that they don't provoke any kind of subjective reactions in that person. But when the words reach the person simply, the sage, the person just accepts whatever is said without reacting to them subjectively. They don't mean anything in the sense of they're not taken as referring to me, to I, what's being said about me. But the words just come. Of course, the words are understood. They're appreciated, but they don't provoke this reaction. And the person is passionless, rid of lust, and the sense faculties are well composed, well, the person has control over the sense faculties. Okay, just do one more verse. Can just take that very quickly.
Yo ve tita to ta sarang va ujum vi gu chati kam me hi pa pa ke hi vi mang samano vi samang samancha tang va pidi rast muning ve dayanti.
Okay, one who has a steadfast mind, here firm-minded, who is straight as a shuttle. The shuttle, I don't have any experience using a spinning wheel, so I don't quite know what the shuttle. Shuttle is something which is attached to the two ends of a spinning wheel and moves back and forth between them like this. Okay, who is disgusted with evil actions and investigates what is good and what is bad, what is righteous and what is unrighteous. This is the kind of person that they call a sage. I think this verse can be taken to again, to underscore the ethical uprightness of a sagely person, that firmness, that straightness, that ujung, that word translated straight, means a firm commitment to rightness, to uprightness in one's bodily actions, one's verbal actions, and one's thinking. And that's expressed as a kind of disgust or repulsion with evil actions. Not so much despising other people, but having a kind of innate repulsion towards unethical behavior. But one doesn't just make quick judgments about what's good or bad, but before one makes a judgment, one investigates. When one hears reports about people's behavior, one investigates what is right and what is wrong, what is good and what is bad. Okay, I'll stop at this point, and then next time I'll try to finish the sutta. Okay, I thank you all for your attention, and may the blessings of the Noble Triple Gem be with you all. Okay, we'll end with the sharing of the merits.
Akasata chabumata deva naga mahitika punyantang anumodipva chirang rakantu sasanang akasata chabumata Deva Naga Mahitika Punyantang Anumoditva Chirang Rakantu Desanang Akasata Chabumata Deva Naga Mahitika Punyantang Anumoditva Chirang Rakantu Mangparang Etavataja Amhehi Sampadang Punya Sampadang Sabe deva anumodantu, sabba sampati siddhya, etavatacha amhehi sampadang punya sampadang, sabe bhuta anumodantu, sabba sampati siddhya, etavatacha amhehi sampadang punya sampadang, Sabbe sata anumodantu, sabba sampati siddhya.